Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hi, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York, and it's Friday. Today, we sit at the halfway point. 2 years have passed since the worst attack on the United States Capitol in centuries, and 2 years remain before the next presidential inauguration. At this crucial mile marker, it's important to stare into the mirror of who we really are as a country. 2 years after, lies and conspiracies about Trump's big loss led to, quote, medieval combat on the steps of the U.S. Capitol between law enforcement and Trump supporters. Those very same lies that inspired that attack 2 years ago are now deeply embedded in the politics of the GOP. They are the single animating principle behind everything that happens in one of the country's two major political parties. It is in large part due to the fact that the man who, quote, summoned the mob, assembled the mob, and lit the flame of the attack, as January 6th Select Committee member Liz Cheney so memorably put it, that would be the disgraced, twice impeached ex-president himself, as well as many of his top lieutenants, remain the dominant force within the GOP. And they insist on continuing to gaslight Americans about what actually happened on January 6th to this day, to this hour on this day. Just yesterday, a spat between the ex-president and Kevin McCarthy over a claim that was too much for Kevin McCarthy. I know, right? Of all people. From the Washington Post reporting, former President Donald Trump said late Thursday that he, quote, totally disagrees with the assessment of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, that the Capitol police officer who shot Ashley Babbitt during the January 6th attack on the Capitol did his job. McCarthy had weighed in on the issue earlier Thursday when asked by a reporter if he agreed with the recent characterization by Marjorie Taylor Greene that Babbitt was murdered by a Capitol police officer while she was trying to breach the doors near the House chamber on January 6th. But election denialism these days goes even farther than that. It goes farther than making a martyr out of Ashley Babbitt or claiming that January 6th was just a tourist visit, as one congressman put it, or legitimate political discourse, as the RNC officially declared it. It also means believing that every election that doesn't go the GOP way is therefore tainted with fraud. In today's Republican Party, gone are the days when losing an election means you say we left it all on the field and then ride off into the sunset and try again next time. Washington Post reports that this about failed Republican candidate Carrie Lake. Lake's loss provided fresh grievances for many Make America Great Again conservatives who refer to her as Governor Lake, despite her loss to Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, the real governor. In November, on Sunday, hundreds of supporters crowded onto a Scottsdale, Arizona golf course where Lake, who is not a governor, headlined a Save Arizona rally and reiterated her false claim that the election was intentionally marred by election officials in the state's largest county. Trump called into the rally, declaring that Lake would ultimately prove victorious in her attempts to overturn the election results. As Politico's reporting on the big lie in Arizona puts it, quote, denialism and its attendant conspiracies animate a large swath of the Republican Party still. And if Arizona is any example, it suggests that not an insignificant percentage of the national electorate is determined to run the same doomed experiment again in 24. This is all happening, even as every day brings fresh evidence that those who spread the big lie knew full well that they were indeed lying at the time. The Associated Press has obtained recordings of Trump campaign staffers on November 5th, 2020, 2 days after Election Day, that reveal a, quote, behind-the-scenes look at how former President Trump's campaign team in a pivotal battleground state knew they'd been outflanked by Democrats in the 2020 election. But even as they acknowledged defeat, they pivoted to allegations of widespread fraud that were ultimately debunked repeatedly by elections officials and the courts. Here's Andrew Iverson, the head of the Trump campaign in Wisconsin.
Here's the drill. Tom's is going to continue to fan the flame and get the word out about Democrats trying to steal this election. We'll do whatever they need our help with. Okay, so just be on standby in case there's any stunts we need to pull.
As the AP reports, Iverson is now the Midwest Regional Director for the RNC. Iverson deferred all questions from the Associated Press to the RNC, which then declined to comment. Election denialism fueling and animating the GOP with 2 years to go ahead of the next presidential inauguration is where we start today. Former Democratic Congresswoman Elaine Loria of Virginia is here. She served on the January 6th Select Committee. Also joining us, Washington Post national investigative reporter Carol Lenig is here. And Tim Miller's back, writer-at-large for The Bulwark. Carol and Tim are MSNBC contributors. Congresswoman, I want to start with you. The investigation is the best and the deepest look into how the lie led to violence, direct link, everyone eyes wide open. I wonder what your thoughts are as we see all these people who were instrumental in that coup plot now already on the field ahead of the next election in this country in 2024.
Well, I think it's very concerning. Where I keep, turning my focus is the fact that the group of people I think who continue the most to perpetuate these lies are the Republicans in the House. You mentioned the comment by Kevin McCarthy was actually a little moving the needle tiny a bit that could be encouraging that, at least in some aspect, he's facing the truth. I think we all remember that, right after January 6th, he showed up, he said the right things, he condemned the violence, he said that Trump held responsibility for what had happened that day. But obviously, he quickly took a turn on that. And the Republican caucus in the House has just been the most amplifying voice in my mind for these lies and perpetuating them.
It's jarring and it borders on surreal to watch the 19 members who were at the White House helping to plan to overturn the election. And a lot of them were outed as having been seeking pardons. It's amazing. And surreal is a word I keep coming to see them have ascended to such power brokers in the House. I want to just go back to your closing statement from the public hearings over the summer, though, about the chain of command for January 6th.
Donald Trump summoned a violent mob and promised to lead that mob to the Capitol to compel those he thought would cave to that kind of pressure. And when he was thwarted in his effort to lead the armed uprising, he instigated the attackers to target the vice president with violence, a man who just wanted to do his constitutional duty. So in the end, this is not as it may appear. A story of inaction in a time of crisis. But instead, it was the final action of Donald Trump's own plan to usurp the will of the American people and remain in power. Not until it was clear that his effort to violently disrupt or delay the counting of the election results had failed did he send a message to his supporters in which he commiserated with their pain. And he told them affectionately to go home. That was not the message of condemnation and just punishment for those who broke the law that we expect from a president whose oath and duty is to ensure the laws are faithfully executed. But instead, it was his newest version of stand back and stand by.
Congresswoman, I pulled that because the newest version of stand back and stand by as of today includes Donald Trump fighting with Kevin McCarthy when he sought to defend a Capitol Police officer who shot Ashley Babbitt. And the loss of any life is always a tragedy. But Kevin McCarthy has it right this time. But Donald Trump is still asking his supporters to stand back and stand by. What are your concerns on the security front?
I think it's very concerning, from the onset when the former president made those remarks at the debate, essentially, making a wink and a nod to this group that, intended to, or at least in previous times had insinuated using violence. And the fact that he continues to perpetuate that lie, continues to rile up people with these claims of a stolen election, And if that is coming from the person who at this point is still the de facto leader of the Republican Party, who by polling is shown to, you know, have a lead against any potential other contenders, it's very concerning for how this could turn out in the future of elections in 2024. We see people in 2022, as has been noted, Carrie Lake, for example, who, you know, is now hosting massive rallies talking about this election fraud, how it was stolen from her. And, you know, I think that unfortunately we're going to see more of this. And it's just undermining, you know, the trust of the American people, the trust in government, and the trust in elections that, you know, the former president is the person who's at the center of this and has not yet been held accountable under the law.
What do we, I mean, the piece that was so clear by the end of the public hearings was that what the committee had evidence of was intent to lie. There's a piece of General Milley's transcript that came out where Trump has said to him, I think it's in the context of Iran, let the next guy deal with it. We lost. We're leaving. You've got Cassidy Hutchinson having that incredible encounter with Trump on the colonnade where he says, I just don't want anyone to know, Mark, that we lost. You've got these Wisconsin guys saying, when we come up short, just run the playbook. Just say we actually won. You have all these. I mean, the tragedy politically just happens on the right. The tragedy nationally and for our security and our democracy happens to all of us. But they're really treating their voters like dupes and dopes. They knowingly lie to them when they know that the election results are real. What is the importance of holding that fraudulent criminal behavior accountable on DOJ's part?
I think it's essential. And I think one of the very important things, in addition to the evidence that we laid out, the intent that we displayed through our report, is the fact that we made referrals to the Department of Justice. Of course, you know, this came up frequently, you know, as people come up to me and say, are you going to hold them accountable? And I said, well, you know, as a congressional committee, there's a limit to how we can do that. We can put the information out to the public. Our role is legislative. It's oversight. But to hold them accountable under the law, the Department of Justice is going to have to take that role. And I feel like our referrals have passed that along. We are seeing by the interviews before a grand jury of many people who are close to the former president's inner circle that they are continuing that work. And, you know, I'm watching, as is everyone else, for the results of that investigation and do hope for the future of our country that it will result in holding the former president and those people close to him who knowingly used false information to deceive people about the election. We'll hold them accountable for these actions.
Carol Lenig, because we have all covered Trump for 6 years, we have been around probably more lawyers and legal scholars than at any other point in American news and journalism. And it seems that two things come through, right? The criminal justice system is there to punish criminal acts. It's also there to make sure they don't happen again, right? Some of the judges have made those points in the sentencing hearings of those violent extremists who've been found guilty of seditious conspiracy. Some very pointed comments for some of the lesser charges as well. Donald Trump's crimes, even the ones that were referred by the committee, are ongoing. This is what Congressman Jamie Raskin said today in an interview with the Deadline Legal blog. Interference with a federal proceeding, in this case, the joint session of Congress, counting Electoral College votes, was not the only crime, but it was the whole point of Stop the Steal. That was Trump's complete and obvious and naked intent to get people to go in and interfere with the counting of votes and to stop it, delay it, postpone it by any means necessary. So that just seems completely straightforward. And that's one of the referrals. We think there will be charges probably on some things we didn't even have because we don't have all the prosecutorial resources that the Department of Justice has. And so we think they probably collected a lot more evidence than we got. Do you agree with that? Do you think they now have more evidence than Congresswoman Luria's committee had?
Congresswoman Luria's committee and Congressman Raskin's committee and Congresswoman Zoe Loughran's committee was way ahead of the Department of Justice, Nicole, as you know. But Raskin is absolutely right that the Department of Justice has entirely bigger guns, so to speak, when it comes to getting specific information that somebody may, say, claim privilege. You know, Pat Cipollone, former White House counsel, had a lot of front row seat time with Donald Trump as he planned and plotted how he would block the peaceful transfer of power, how he would hold on, despite the will of the voters, that he be ejected from the presidency. And now the Department of Justice has this route to getting a fuller account from Pat Cipollone than the committee did. And that's true for many other witnesses. I think it's possible for them to learn quite a bit more. However, I will just put a cautionary piece of tape around this conversation and say, we don't know what they've obtained yet. You know, they were far enough behind that we don't know how far they've gotten in terms of exceeding the information that the committee laid out to the public. Those referrals for TV time were quite a while ago, but it's a very brief period of time for the Department of Justice.
And I guess, Carol, if we look at this moment, you know, we're exactly 2 years from the last inauguration season. We're exactly 2 years from another inauguration of an American president. To your point, very little work had gone into investigating the conduct of the president or his inner circle. And it's not just the ongoing nature of the specific crimes that the committee referred. It's the remorselessness. It's Hope Hicks saying, we're never going to get jobs. We now look like domestic terrorists, you know, that we were. I mean, the idea that this is now, there's no civil war on the right. There's no soul searching. There's no autopsy. There's more grappling with how it looked to have your supporters stabbing cops with flagpoles. They're all in. That's 2024 MAGA, baby. What is the absence of accountability in America's sort of judicial system? What impact do you think it's having in our politics?
Well, you know, I'm going to just use a slightly different example to get to the answer to your question, which is really about the consequences of accountability delayed, let's say. And by the way, I'm not luckily in the position of having to make charging decisions, which are still off in the future, and we don't know what those will be. We can't prejudge evidence that's not before us. However, let's just put for a moment the drama that was January 6th. At that moment, FBI agents and all senior Justice Department officials, including basically people who had been installed by Donald Trump and owed their jobs to Donald Trump, were in a peripatetic, frantic effort to make sure that there was not a return repeat attack on the inauguration. They spent a painful, frantic 2 weeks trying to make sure that nothing possibly could happen. Any of the individuals who are rioters, people they were tied to come back and hurt the country in the same way that they had on January 6th. Well, a lot of those people were arrested and got search warrants and subpoenas, and they were taken off the field of battle. To your question, a lot of people who were engaged in attacking democracy in a soft, nonviolent way. Soft is a poor adjective, I know, but in a nonviolent way, that were pulling levers with Donald Trump's help or with his direction to try to block that transfer of power that we've all taken for granted in this country. Those people are still on the playing field. Should they be charged? Again, a decision for someone else in the Department of Justice, not for me, but they are still on the field, and indeed they're running laps around it. So I think you kind of know the answer to your question.
Yeah, I mean, Tim, this Wisconsin story is something we pulled out and brought into focus because an architect of a knowing fraud, someone who, like Donald Trump, knew he lost in November and just wanted votes to be found, is now been promoted. He has a bigger job. He's not just in charge of Wisconsin. The RNC made him the Midwest director. And in the old days, the way the map used to be, that was a pretty important job. Carrie Lake, instead of retiring and looking for a job at Fox News like Sarah Palin did when she lost, is now holding, I don't know what she's holding, fake governor rallies, wait for victory days. I mean, it is the last thing I would like to cover here. But until there is something that shows that we're not going to walk like zombies into another January 6th that maybe spreads to other state capitals based on the same script and the same grievances and the same conspiracies, simply with more examples of more political violence under our belt as a country in New Mexico and San Francisco, I'm not sure there's a more ominous flashing yellow sign in American politics.
Boy, Nicole, you're on fire today, just have to say. I do have, it's hard for me to compete with all this. Yes, yes, yes to everything, with one exception, one nit. You said earlier, it's been 6 years we've been dealing with this. Actually, we're a couple months away from the 8-year anniversary of the escalator. That's how long we've been dealing with this,
God.
You know what. I know, that's a triggering realization I had this morning. So look, the Kari Lake thing, I think, is a prime example of what you're talking about, just how deep this rot is and how, you know, despite having a really encouraging midterm, you know, we have to be eyes wide open and we are not out of the woods. Not only did she have that rally in Arizona, which just as a standalone, I mean, that is insane. It's madness. Hundreds of people showing up for a loser's rally, you know, across from the AFC Championship football game. Like, you know, when other things are going on with our lives, like imagine if Charlie Crist tried to have a rally in Florida, you know, like the Democrats are not a cult. Like people, are, you know, and I think he could have a nice little luncheon or something. But, you know, like this, it's insane to think that this person that had lost, that throughout all of our history, you know, would just be moving on, maybe even aspirationally trying to help the incumbent governor and see ways that they could work together. No, holding fake rallies, hundreds of people showing up. That's a bad sign. Here's another bad sign. She went to D.C. after that rally and held meetings at the National Republican Senatorial Committee. They invited her in to the office to discuss her potential Senate bid. You know, someone that is continuing to fan these anti-democratic flames, continuing to kind of lead an assault against the democratic system. Nobody at the NRSC is like, hey, you know, maybe we shouldn't invite this person in. If she wants to run, she can run, but, you know, we don't need to have our stamp upon it. No, this rot goes throughout the entire ecosystem. No one is standing up. You have the NRSC is inviting her. You have the regional political director of the RNC, you know, participating in this fraud. It the tentacles go all the way into all of these local campaigns. And so when people say, when are we going to be able to get back to normal? When are we going to get back to normal? Well, we can't. Until these people have repudiated what happened. And instead of repudiating it, the people who were involved and participating in the insurrection have gotten promotions, at least on the internal Republican Party side of things. You know, thank goodness the voters had better wisdom than that in the midterms. But with the party itself, no, there's been no repudiation, no accountability. People are getting rewarded for continuing to advance the lies that led to January 6th.
And Tim, there's like a delicious irony to that. Like, how about this? We'll help you run for Senate if you concede the governor's race. I mean, it's like laughable in its face. And I know the Republican Party's changed a whole lot since I was a part of it. But it has to be easier, not harder, to raise money if you don't have someone who still believes in her imagination she's governor on your slate of senatorial candidates.
Yeah, but here's the other thing. This bench, and so we talked about this with Santos and how a guy like this gets through, right? You're the NRSC. What are your other options? Blake Masters, who just lost by 5 points. A handful of other insane insurrectionists, right? You know, you could zag and go back to, you know, one of the handful of local Republican officials. There are a few in Arizona who opposed what Kari Lake did and what Trump had did. But you know that they don't have a chance in a primary, right? And so, yeah, I mean, we have to treat these people like children, where the strategists who know better at the NRSC have to, like, offer a cookie and a carrot to get somebody to do the thing that every politician ever in history has done, is just concede and move on, you know, in order to, you know, try to get some kind of viable person that can run next time.
It's an amazing state of affairs. Carol Enig, Tim Miller, thank you so much for starting us off on a Friday. Elaine Luria sticks around a little longer. When we come back, an intelligence gathering balloon. This is a story everyone in your life is talking about. It's been detected over Montana. It is moving over the United States. This is not a bad movie, new on Netflix. It is an international incident happening right now. The Pentagon says the balloon is from China, and it has set off both diplomatic and military alarms. There are more questions than answers at this hour. We will ask them next. Plus, the state of Michigan is showing the country what it is like to have Democrats in full control of state government. That power is being used around issues like expanding protections for LGBTQ Americans living in Michigan and securing abortion rights there. Michigan is in focus today, though, because it stands in stark contrast to what is happening in places like Florida, where outrageous things that don't seem real when you read them are being proposed when it comes to dealing with our country's children. Later in the program, Alan Weisselberg again, already in prison at Rikers for his work for the Trump Org. He could turn out to be a key witness in another alleged crime. committed by the twice impeached ex-president, how Manhattan prosecutors may be turning up the pressure on him. The Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere this Friday.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Yesterday, the Department of Defense announced that we had detected and were tracking a high-altitude surveillance balloon that remains over the continental United States. We continue to track and monitor the balloon closely. We're confident this is a Chinese surveillance balloon. I made clear that the presence of this surveillance balloon in U.S. airspace is a clear violation of U.S. sovereignty and international law, that it's an irresponsible act, and that the PRC's decision to take this action on the eve of my planned visit is detrimental to the substantive discussions that we were prepared to have.
Part terrifying mystery, part SNL skit. That was Secretary of State Anthony Blinken in just the last hour on what is now a postponed trip to Beijing, in which he was expected to meet with President Xi Jinping after the U.S. announced yesterday that a Chinese high-altitude balloon was spotted hovering over the northwest part of the country. I think it was in Montana at the time, saying that it is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty and must be removed from our airspace. The Pentagon detected the balloon Thursday over Montana, where officials said it was gathering intelligence about one of our country's military bases that operates and stores intercontinental ballistic missiles, of all things. In a briefing today, the Pentagon press secretary said the balloon is moving eastward and that it poses no physical threat to those on the ground. China has stated that the balloon was for civilian meteorological research and it had gone off course. Joining us now, MSNBC military analyst, retired four-star general Barry McCaffrey. He was a former member of the National Security Council. Former Congresswoman Elaine Lurie is back with us. She was a former Navy commander. And while in the House, she served as vice chair of the Armed Services Committee. General McCaffrey, so this has already, I think, seeped into our culture. Everyone everywhere is asking, why don't we just shoot it down, including all of the Republican primary candidates, people like Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley. Why don't we just shoot it down?
Well, there's a lot of theatrical bravado going on in Washington, which is unfortunate. It's very reassuring to listen to Secretary Blinken. What a thoughtful, measured, sober-minded, experienced diplomat he is. This is a provocation. It looks like it's an uncoordinated action by the Chinese military. It's hardly a covert collection device. These balloons are up at 100,000 to 150,000 feet. It was seen by pilots, commercial pilots, photographed from the ground, hovering over 150 ICBM Minuteman III missiles out of Malmstrom Air Force Base. It's just a goofy move on the part of the Chinese. I mean, and their denial is expected, but doesn't make any sense. So I think shooting it down opens us to the PLA then one-upping all this. We collect at sea and offshore in the air, possibly by other means against China. We don't want this to turn into a shooting war. This thing represents no kinetic threat to the United States. By the way, it is a pretty good collection device for a poor country. It stays up slowly over a site. They can guide it somewhat by air currents. At 150,000 feet, it's a lot lower than a 300-mile up suborbital satellite. So the Chinese really screwed this one up something terrible.
I mean, I think the other thing that's going on, though, in conversations that I've heard in my own life is that the Chinese look pretty brazen. Why would they do this?
My gut instinct is the PLA got out in front, didn't coordinate it. President Xi is increasingly running an authoritarian regime. The PLA takes preeminence in his government. They're heavily involved in internal security and suppression of the Uyghurs. aggressive action in Senaku Islands off Japan, aggressive action in the South China Sea. So the PLA, it's worrisome, looks less responsive to a whole of government control. This is not a good move. I mean, why would they collect with something so visible from the target? And it just didn't make much sense from the start. Secretary Blinken wisely has postponed the trip to China. We had to respond in some way, but it seems unlikely that shooting it down accomplishes anything good and opens the door to other reactions from the PLA.
So, Congresswoman, what do we do? Just let it fly over the rest of our country gathering stuff?
Well, I think that Secretary Blinken's delay of his travel postponement was absolutely the appropriate thing to do. I think we have to send a strong signal to China that we don't accept this type of surveillance collection, in airspace over the United States. And, you know, I think that we need to be more forward leaning towards their provocative action. In our national security strategy, it clearly outlines that we care about a free and open Indo-Pacific. But at the same time, we've allowed this continued provocation throughout the region. We've drawn our allies in closer, the Japanese, the Philippines, as we just saw with the base of access that was agreed upon. You know, I understand, but, you know, the one thing about this that, you know, might actually play out in a good way is that it's making the American people pay attention. I felt often on the Armed Services Committee as I was talking about China, talking about the investments we need to make in defense relative to deterring China. It sometimes went on deaf ears, or people said, well, yeah, there's so many other things that we're concerned about today. But now when you can see this large balloon flying over Montana, overtly trying to collect intelligence on, you know, U.S. nuclear assets, you know, people are paying attention to that. And I think that maybe it can help drive the discussion as to why these investments in defense are so important, why clarifying our policy with regards to China is essential.
That's so interesting. I mean, it is, you know, the Republicans' position coming in is to cut defense spending, and it certainly makes that seem like an unwise idea. Can I ask a dumb question? I mean, do we fly balloons over other countries? Is balloon surveillance a thing, Congresswoman?
Well, as the general said, it's certainly not the most advanced method of surveillance that we have. And without getting into, you know, specifics of all the different tools that we have, you know, I'd say that this is not a practice in which we engage with other countries. And, you know, as the general also said, you know, I see it as a provocation. Why would you put the biggest thing, an enormous balloon moving slowly in the air at 60,000 or so feet, visible from the ground over Montana, and have it loiter there? I mean, it seems as though this would be meant to have been detected. And then they're testing us, I think, testing our reaction to this. So I think Secretary Blinken's, you know, not traveling to China at this point is appropriate, but they're testing our reaction all the time, every day. You know, I think that it goes unnoticed for the majority of Americans, not only the overflight of, you know, Taiwanese airspace and intrusion into their waters. It was visible during, you know, former Speaker Pelosi's visit. But the activities, the malign activities that are going on throughout the Pacific with regards to, you know, interruption with fishing rights and the growth of the Chinese Navy specifically, and, you know, the threat that that could pose to a free and open Indo-Pacific, I think that, you know, this is an opportunity to change that dialogue, to talk about that more, and to really be more forward-leaning on our policy and with our allies on how we need to react in the Pacific.
I mean, on that, General McCaffrey, if they're measuring how we respond and it's a balloon, what are they telling themselves? That America noticed, they covered it on cable news, they canceled a trip, but what? I mean, it's still flying all across our country, gathering whatever it's gathering. And I think to most Americans, it looks like we didn't do anything.
Yeah, well, you know, again, I think this is primarily a goofy move on the part of the PLA. They're probably not coordinated in any way with the rest of their government. It didn't make much sense. It wasn't a covert collector. It's not going to provide any significant new intelligence they didn't have before. They are clearly, the Congresswoman said, provoking us. Taiwan is the key. They are crossing the median line with naval and air power routinely now. They're leaning forward, potentially considering not so much an invasion of Taiwan as a blockade and isolation. They've been aggressive toward the Japanese. But as we speak, the Biden administration done pretty well in this. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's out in the Philippines, just having signed a significant enhancement of our military presence to fill in a gap in the sort of the island chain to isolate China from being out in the general Pacific Ocean. So we're doing pretty well. We do have to ramp up U.S. Navy and air power. We must invest in deterrence in the Pacific. We're not adequately funded at present.
General Barry McCaffrey and Elaine Loria, any excuse to talk to both of you on a Friday, including a Chinese balloon flying across our country, is a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you to both of you for spending some time with us. Up next, it's a story so unbelievable that it seems like something out of a dystopian novel, except it's really happening in Ron DeSantis' Florida. We'll tell you about some of the things being planned in the most extreme pockets of Red America. Don't go anywhere. After sweeping victories at every level in the state by Democrats in these midterm elections, legislators are hard at work protecting their constituents from Republican MAGA-style extremism. That's in Michigan. Senators are working at expanding the state's Civil Rights Act to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Similar bills have stalled in the legislature for decades. The bill likely will become law now that Democrats have a majority in both chambers for the first time in 40 years. And the timing couldn't be more urgent as more and more red states are looking to follow what's happening in Florida. And that state's lurched to the far right. Governor Ron DeSantis has made a name for himself ahead of an expected run for president in 2024 by pushing some of the most damaging laws on one of Florida's most vulnerable populations, its students and kids. Case in point, high school student athletes in the state of Florida could soon be required to report their menstrual history, the dates of their cycles, to their schools. The Miami Herald is reporting this, quote, a form, if approved, would ask students if they've had a menstrual cycle, and if so, at what age they had their first menstrual period, their most recent menstrual period, and how many periods the student has had in the last 12 months. Wow. Joining us now, Michigan State Democratic Senator, an outspoken advocate for LGBTQ rights and all humans, Mallory McMurrow is back. It's just such a study in contrast. It's what Democratic leadership and control looks like in Michigan next to what DeSantis is doing in Florida that I think is the most jarring. It's not in a vacuum. It's literally moving backward compared to moving forward. What do you think when you see it?
I think that's exactly right. And Governor Whitmer laid out in her State of the State address, she said bigotry is bad for business. And just to put a finer point on that, I want to talk about just how dystopian and creepy what is happening in Florida is right now. To the idea that getting even out of LGBTQ issues, that the state and schools would be asking to track girls' periods is just disgusting. There's one party right now that consistently wants to talk about genitals and menstrual cycles. And then there's Michigan, where we are going in a very different direction. We are saying loudly, everybody is welcome here. If you want to make it, you can make it in Michigan. And I think it's a bet that we're going to win in the long run.
You know, a mistake that people like myself made during the Trump years was looking for the bottom and sort of projecting and maybe covering it as a false reassurance to our viewers. Okay, we're here. Here it is. Here's the worst thing that's going to happen. Grabbing women in the bleep wasn't it, but it's bad people on both sides of the case. Oh, no. It's stealing election machines to overturn the election. Oh, no. It's having dinner with Nick Fuentes and Kanye. No, wait, hang on. I think we're making the same mistake with DeSantis, right? Because everything is so appalling. Don't say gay. Tell us your menstrual cycles. But to your point about the dystopian tone, what is the natural end if he's made clear where he's heading?
You know, I think that that is the lesson we have to learn, that there is no bottom. And when people are showing you who they are, believe them. What happened in Michigan in 2016 is that a lot of people were willing to turn a blind eye towards Donald Trump bragging about sexual assault, demonizing immigrants, demonizing the handicapped for this promise that he was going to make America great again, especially in a state like ours that is built on manufacturing. People really wanted to hold on to that economic promise. And it didn't come to fruition. There was no economic gain. It's just culture wars. And Ron DeSantis, you know, a lot of Republicans are holding him up as the future nominee. He's the rational one. He's not as crazy as Donald Trump, but this is crazy. And we have to recognize that right now, paint him for what he is. This is, it's disgusting. You know, this is the same type of behavior we saw in Michigan with Larry Nassar, who wanted to know about girls and their periods and get into, you know, violations that we should not stand for. We need to call it right now and recognize him for who he is.
In Michigan, you and Governor Whitmer and Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, you have an ability, and we have studied it here, so I'm not trying to compliment you, but there is a language of inclusion. It is not Democratic priorities and principles just for us, the Democrats in the state. It is policies that are appropriate for this moment that also acknowledge economic anxiety and seek to lift everybody up. How do you take that and build this sort of permanent coalition coast to coast?
I'm really excited about the pathway that we're laying in Michigan. And I don't think it's a mistake that you see a state now led by women who vividly remember. We're never going to forget what happened in 2016. And I think the lesson that we've all learned is that you have to do both. We have to lay out our democratic values when it comes to social issues and inclusion. And we also have to do the work to make the economy work for everybody. So here already, we've passed legislation to expand the earned income tax credit. We've passed legislation to repeal the retirement tax. This is a tax that Governor Snyder put on pensioners to give a $1.8 billion break to big businesses when he was here. So we're taking that back so that seniors can retire with dignity on a fixed income. And we're showing that you can do both. We can be inclusive and we can help your bottom line and help everybody here deal with the challenges of inflation and just move forward in a way that protecting everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that everybody, I mean, media and every, we fall into these, the right likes to paint false choices. If you have this, you can't have that. And you guys certainly are writing the playbook for how to blow that out. I want to ask you about some other stories we've been covering this week. We're going to ask Michigan State Senator Mallory McMurrow to stay through a quick break. We'll both be right back.
I am a straight, white, Christian, married, suburban mom who knows that the very notion that learning about slavery or redlining or systemic racism somehow means that children are being taught to feel bad or hate themselves because they are white is absolute nonsense. No child alive today is responsible for slavery. No one in this room is responsible for slavery. But each and every single one of us bears responsibility for writing the next chapter of history.
So I thought of that when we have covered this week the moves, not just in the state of Florida, to do away with some of the AP history courses focused on African American studies, but to influence them at a national level. And I wanted your thoughts on that story.
You know, it's not surprising, but it's just so devastating that this continues to be the playbook, that there were no lessons learned from 2022 for Republicans. If they had learned, they would recognize that the culture wars are not a winning strategy. But the strategy now seems to be double and triple down. We have to split people apart, force people to hate each other, and it's going to be on the rest of us. I think about it every day. Those of us who are comfortable, those of us who come for a place of privilege, to stand up and say no. And that has to happen in every state, and especially as we head into 2024.
And on, specifically around the issue of police reform, which seems to surge to agendas in Washington when we as a country, and you know, I'm not saying it affects everyone evenly, it doesn't, but the trauma of watching a young black man beaten by police officers is, you know, roiling the country right now, but the agenda isn't always front and center. I thought again of your speech and wonder what you think the responsibility is of all citizens to keep that issue front and center.
It's all of our responsibility. I now represent a district that covers the entire racial and economic spectrum here in Michigan, from Detroit through Birmingham. And when I talk to Detroit residents, they want police who are responsive, who show up when they're called, and they want communities to be safe for everybody. And that means for everybody. Sarah Anthony, who's our new appropriations chair, the first Black woman to ever hold that position in the state, she had a speech this week that says she wants to know that her little brother is safe driving around, yes, when he has a hoodie on. We have to keep pushing for that. All of us have to stand up and say these things are not at odds with each other. We can support police and we can support accountability. We can support funding for recruitment and we can ensure that people who abuse this power are held responsible. And a lot of that is just rejecting the dichotomy that Republicans have tried to force on us time and time again, that it's Black or white, it's one or the other, and it's not. It's both. And we all have to stand up and say so.
Michigan lived through, and your governor obviously prevailed politically and in terms of her personal safety, thank God, a brutal plot against her by violent extremists. As you watch, again, a Republican Party really grapple, not even grapple, but move toward more guns being allowed in hearing rooms, toward elevating people who were instrumental in the insurrection, what are your warnings for them as they seem to not take the threat of political violence seriously?
Look, I think we have to take 2022 as a sign of hope, that there was a lot of concern about violence and chaos. And what I take away from the 2022 midterms is that decency prevailed, democracy prevailed, but that it's going to take constant work. Here in Michigan, Attorney General Dan Nessel just testified in front of our new elections committee about the need to stiffen penalties. The fact that it is the same penalty if you falsify a $200 check as it is if you spread misinformation about elections. And that's not okay. We have to make sure there are stiff penalties, that people are going to be held responsible for this. But I am concerned, encouraged actually, that it feels like a smaller and smaller group. But we have to make sure that we continue that process moving forward and we all stay as engaged as we were in these midterms as we head into the next major election cycle.
It's always great to focus in on what's happening there. Michigan State Senator Mallory McMorrow, thank you for spending some time with us today on all this.
Thank you.
Up next for us, new pressure from prosecutors is being applied right now as we speak to Donald Trump's former CFO, as a brand new blockbuster book is shining a bright light on the Manhattan DA's investigation into the ex-president's finances. NBC News has just obtained those excerpts. We'll bring them to you next. Don't go anywhere.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Years later, as he was now going to be entering the final stage of the campaign, he's already the Republican candidate. She returns, meaning Stormy Daniels. And I'm in communication with Keith Davidson, her attorney. We negotiate a settlement. This is all done with Donald, with Alan Weisselberg.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York with Alan Weisselberg. He was always there, always in the room, always by his boss's side. The former Trump Org CFO, who's now serving 5 months at Rikers Island for his role in the company's criminal tax fraud scheme, also has direct knowledge of lots of other things, including the hush money payments made to Stormy Daniels. There's new reporting that reveals that the Manhattan DA, who is moving full steam ahead now with his criminal investigation into the hush money payment, is looking to turn up the heat on the man who could be a key witness. From the New York Times reporting, quote, as the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, jumpstarts his office's effort to indict Trump, his prosecutors are using the prospect of additional charges to exert leverage over Mr. Weisselberg. It's according to people with knowledge of the matter. The potential charges, which prosecutors conveyed to the former executive's legal team this week, center on insurance fraud and could lead to a significant prison sentence for Mr. Weisselberg, who is 75. Now, the loyal Trump employee did not flip on the ex-president in the last investigation, but as the Times is reporting, this new development could change his calculus. Quote, the potential new charges against Weisselberg are unrelated to the hush money, but he has long been the missing piece in any criminal case against the former president. The threat of prison time could change the equation for Mr. Weisselberg, who could face a stark choice, serving significant time behind bars late in his life or turning on the former president, whose finances he handled for decades. Off the heels of that news, the Times is out this afternoon with a preview of a new book that could have devastating consequences for Alvin Bragg and his office. The book, out next week, is written by Mark Pomerantz. He's a prosecutor who resigned from Bragg's office last year after Bragg chose not to indict Trump at that time. The Times reports this, quote, for months beforehand, Mr. Pomerantz had mapped out a wide-ranging possible case against the former president under the state racketeering law. That's according to the soon-to-be-published book, The People versus Donald Trump. That broader approach was based on a theory that Trump had presided over a corrupt business empire for years, a previously unreported aspect of the long-running inquiry. Mr. Pomerantz and his colleagues cast a wide net, examining a host of Trump enterprises, including Trump University, his for-profit real estate education venture, and his family charitable foundation. Quote, he demanded absolute loyalty and would go after anyone who crossed him. He seemed always to stay one step ahead of the law. Mr. Pomerantz, a prominent litigator who has prosecuted and defended organized crime cases, writes of Trump, quote, in my career as a lawyer, I had encountered only one other person who touched all these bases, John Gotti, the head of the Gambino organized crime family. Now, lucky for us, Mark Pomerantz will be our guest right here on this program, on this set on Tuesday. We can ask him all about what he's writing. We're only seeing snippets of it. Putting the squeeze on the former Trump Organization CFO is where we begin today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Barbara McQuaid is back. She's a former U.S. attorney, now a law professor at the University of Michigan. Andrew Weissman is also back, former Justice Department prosecutor, former senior member of Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation. With me at the table, Tim O'Brien. He's Bloomberg Opinion senior executive editor and the host of Bloomberg's Crash Course podcast. Lucky for us, they're all MSNBC contributors. Just as a bit more table setting, let me show you former FBI director Jim Comey on Trump, aka the mob.
How strange is it for you to sit here and compare the president to a mob boss?
Very strange. And I don't do it lightly. And I'm not trying to, by that, by the way, suggest that President Trump is out breaking legs and shaking down shopkeepers. But instead, what I'm talking about is that leadership culture constantly comes back to me when I think about my experience with the Trump administration.
Andrew Weissman, people who were up close and personal to Donald Trump, and some of it comes through in the transcripts that have been released by the January 6th Select Committee, people who interacted with Trump do describe him the way Jim Comey and Mark Pomerantz seem to. You've investigated his inner circle. Does that ring true?
It does. And I remember hearing Jim Comey say that, and even though I was going to be working on the special counsel investigation, I remember at the time thinking that that was a lot of hyperbole by Jim and sort of poo-pooed that. And then the more that I looked into it, I unfortunately really had to agree that, and again, I think it's important to note that he's not saying that he's like him in terms of the kind of murder and the equating the types of crimes to what the former president did. But in terms of what he expects in terms of loyalty, the disregard for the rule of law, the idea that, you know, you owe everything to him and not to the Constitution in any way. Unfortunately, I do think that that is an accurate assessment. So I think this is a place where what Mark Pomerantz reports is something that, you know, I don't think that's the new part of this of the story. I think it's confirmatory of what, frankly, all of us have lived through for you know, quite some time with the former president.
Well, I'm not going to be able to think of a good mob movie off the top of my head, and I have been brushing up. But, you know, Michael Cohen comes out of the Trump org and describes Trump as exactly like a mob boss. You know, even to testify before Congress, he wouldn't be explicit, but you knew what he wanted you to do. Michael Cohen has been open about the fact that he spent time with Alvin Bragg's office since Alvin Bragg has been running it, and since before when Mark Pomerantz was running this investigation. Was it surprising to you at all to understand that they were putting together a racketeering case?
You know, it's not, it wasn't totally surprising. I mean, it is also, according to the New York Times reporting, it's something that Mark and apparently the team looked at, but then discarded. In other words, by the time the sort of late December and when the Vance administration was winding down and the Bragg administration was starting, that idea of bringing this sort of enterprise or RICO case seems like it had been abandoned, according to the New York Times, and it was a much more focused case. And that makes sense. I mean, a lot of times when you're starting to investigate, you have different theories and you explore different avenues and you end up somewhere else. But Nicole, let me just give you one quick amusing vignette of relating this to the mob. When I was in the special counsel and I reported this, which I remember we were dealing with counsel for Don Jr. and I pick up the phone and on the other side is Alan Frutafast, a very good lawyer in New York. The last time I spoke to him, he represented a soldier in the Columba family in a murder case. That is the last time I talked to him. And now he was calling me to say he represented the son of the president. Now, crazy. Normally, that is, again, no disrespect to Alan Frutafast, but that's not typically who you would see. I mean, usually you see the likes of David Kendall and the sort of absolute cream of the crop, you know, representing people at that level. So that was surprising to me.
Well, and I mean, not to get on too much of a tangent, but I think Don Jr. Doesn't show up or takes. I think the report bears out some of what might be that lawyer's style. I want to press you on one more thing, Andrew, because you write in your book about not getting into all of Trump's finances as in depth as what might have been beneficial. And here's what Pomerantz writes about Trump's finances. Our conclusion from all this work was that Trump's financial statements had overstated the value of his assets by massive amounts. The analysis focused on the years between 2011 and 2017. The overvaluations cut across virtually all of his assets meant that he had reported asset values that on average were about double what they were actually worth. The pattern continued year after year. The assets and amount shifted, but the pattern was unmistakable. The overstatements had to be intentional, which of course is what Michael Cohen has told us. Now, of course, you weren't looking at financial fraud, but just the X-ray that financial documents provide to a man and how he's conducted himself are undeniable, right?
Absolutely. And this is where we do have the benefit of the very, very detailed civil complaint that was brought by the New York Attorney General, that is Letitia James. And that's a civil case, not a criminal case. But that lays out in detail, Nicole, exactly what you're talking about, which is these wildly inflated valuations over and over again, including Donald Trump's own home, where he, you know, says it's over 30,000 square feet when it's actually it's under 11,000 square feet, and the valuation is over $300 million. But then when he becomes president, and people are looking at what he's saying, he slashes that valuation by hundreds of millions of dollars. So there's just this pattern of inflating assets when you're trying to get loans from banks, but deflating all of that when you're trying to figure out how to pay less taxes. So that sort of repeated scheme is something that apparently not only has Mark looked at, but apparently is something that Alvin Bragg's office is continuing to look at.
So let me read you some more of this, Tim, as another person very familiar with Trump's finances and how close or far they stray from the truth. This is from the new book. It's called People versus Donald Trump, an inside account. This is on the golf courses. How had a golf club Trump bought for $5 million cash in December come to be worth $62 million 6 months later? The answer emerged from the testimony of Jeffrey McConney, one of Trump's employees who was deposed by the AG several times in 19 and 20. Trump had paid $5 million to buy the Jupiter golf course in December 2012, but he had also taken on more than $40 million in possible liability to the members of the golf club. Trump's financial statement said that he had decided to value this liability at zero. A careful study of McConney's testimony revealed that the liability Trump had valued at zero had been used to boost the club's purported value to $62 million. Now, I'm not good at math, and I'm not a tax accountant, but even I know those numbers don't come close to adding up.
They don't add up, and most of Donald Trump's finances, the stuff at least he says publicly, have never added up. This was at the core of the lawsuit he filed against me, was because the book accurately reported that he had spent decades inflating the value of everything he touched. At one point, during the litigation, when we were deposing him, we asked him about how he valued the golf courses. And he said, I don't keep any documents on any of that. And we said, you don't even keep a profit and loss statement.
He said, no.
And we said, well, then how do you know what they're worth? And he said, mental projections, which was one of my favorite terms because he's basically gone through his whole life mentally projecting towards everything around him. I think the issue is, yes, of course, he's inflated these things forever. And of course he's lied. And of course he engages in exaggeration, hyperbole. The challenge for prosecutors is to prove that's a crime and that he defrauded the banks in the process and that he knew he was doing, at least in a criminal charge, that he had intent. And I think that was the thing that tore apart the DA's own team. All of them had good intentions, but Mark Pomerantz ended up on one side of the equation and other people in office ended up on another side, and they couldn't resolve their differences about whether they could take all of this excellent evidence they had built to court, charge him criminally, and prove he knew what he was doing. And ultimately, you know, Bragg walks into that office. He inherits an investigation that Cy Vance had launched. Cy Vance leaves without resolving him, dumps this on Bragg's desk, and Bragg decides he doesn't have the goods. And Mark Pomerantz leaves the office. I think there's a good faith argument on both sides of that divided office about whether there was a case or whether there wasn't. I think the thing that's interesting now is I think you have a different case afoot in that office. They may still be looking at bank fraud, but I think what they're pressing Alan Weisselberg on now is accounting fraud. And in addition to the payments to Stormy Daniels. And it's an entirely different case. And I think they're starting to put the screws to Weisselberg on that and to Jeff McConney. There were only three senior people in Trump's office who made most of the big decisions before they were brought to Trump. McConney, Weisselberg, and Jason Greenblatt, one of Trump's lawyers. And nobody did anything in that office without Trump signing off on it. So any of those people who can lay an evidentiary trail to Trump's feet in which they were engaging in accounting fraud and he knew what he was doing and in which they can prove intent, then they've got a nice criminal case against him. And I think that there might be some new fire in Bragg's investigation. The only other thing I want
to... Why?
Because I think they're putting the screws to these guys. I think it's a classic prosecutorial strategy. You turn some of the witnesses into hamburger. You grind them through the grinder and you get them to provide evidence on others. And then you move up the food chain until you get the person at the top of what Mark Pomerantz is describing as a criminal enterprise. And I think it seems like they're on that path. I'm not inside the office, so I don't know. And the one thing I wanted to say about John Gotti is Trump told me once in an interview while I was sitting with him in Trump Tower about how much he admired John Gotti.
Of course he admires John Gotti.
Yeah. And he said, you know, that
guy. Not George Washington or.
He said that guy sat in the courtroom and everybody was coming at him and he never shed a tear. That's the kind of guy I admire. And, you know, this speaks to so many things. Trump's own wild insecurity about his own
sadism.
His sadism, the way he admires thugs, whether it's John Gotti or Vladimir Putin. And I think it's interesting that Pomerantz has surfaced John Gotti in all of this again, too.
Barbara McQuaid, my mind is blown, so it might take me 4 seconds to find my next piece of paper here. But on the Weisselberg piece. We've had a lot of conversations, you and I, about what might be happening as he's on his way to Rikers. As he gets the room at Rikers, it's still Rikers, but it does have a coffee pot. What might be on his mind in terms of how helpful or forthcoming he might be? We assume now that he's, if one settles in at Rikers, that he's in the settling in phase. But here's what the Times writes about this, the Weisselberg piece. Quote, the basis for an insurance fraud charge against Mr. Weisselberg first emerged publicly in a court filing early last year as part of the New York Attorney General's civil investigation into Trump and his family business. That inquiry, separate from the district attorney's criminal investigation, eventually resulted in a September lawsuit against Trump, three of his adult children, and his company. It's scheduled to go to trial in the fall. I guess my question is, if that exposure was known to Alan Weisselberg and his team for that long, why is it now something that they can use to borrow Tim's language, you know, turn the screws on him with?
Well, those charges were filed in a civil case where the standard of proof is preponderance of the evidence. And when Alvin Bragg walked away from this case, it appeared apparent that they weren't going to pursue this criminally. But we don't know all of the reasons, but things apparently have changed. It could be that tax investigation where Alan Weisselberg was convicted and the Trump Organization was convicted. You know, when you put a case together for trial, you dig through every piece of paper, and it could be that they found stronger evidence that made them lead to this case as a criminal charge. And so I don't know how optimistic I would be about whether Alan Weisselberg is going to cooperate against Donald Trump. In that tax case, he did agree to cooperate against the Trump Organization, but he said he didn't have any information against Donald Trump himself. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but it's hard to imagine that he was willing to go to Rikers Island for 5 months and held back something that he knew about Donald Trump, and yet would be willing to change his mind now. But nonetheless, I suppose once you have a taste of Rikers Island and the thought of staying for longer than 5 months, maybe that is more persuasive than any words could ever be.
I mean, I think there's also, and again, I'm not making any commentary about Mr. Weisselberg or what he did or didn't do, but you, watching your family watch you go through that can have sometimes an unexpectedly traumatic result. I don't know anything about his family, but I wonder if that also figures into some of the timing on going to a witness as essential as Mr. Weisselberg. I want to ask you, Barb, we're going to have Mark Pomerantz here on Tuesday, so we'll get a chance to ask him, and we'll get to share everything in the book. All that is available now to NBC News is one chapter, and I've read some of what has been written publicly, and so that's all we've seen so far. But, you know, there have been some people, I mean, people like Michael Cohen, people like Donny Deutsch, people who've been around the Trump orbit for a long time have always thought that a racketeering investigation might be the only way to capture all of the bad slash criminal conduct that happens under the umbrella of Trump. What do you think of that reporting? Whether it was ultimately abandoned, obviously we haven't seen that. But what do you make of that approach to investigating all of Trump's enterprises?
Yeah, so, you know, first, proving any kind of a white-collar case requires willful intent, which can be very difficult to do. It's why people in these crime organizations and white-collar criminal organizations sometimes get away with their crimes, because proving that intent can be so difficult. But it's not impossible. Jurors are instructed to look at the totality of the circumstances, which includes, you know, all of the facts and all of the things people said. And so when it comes to racketeering, that is a great tool when you want to bring under one umbrella a lot of different criminal schemes, but that were all done as part of a pattern of an association. And so that association may be the Trump Organization, but you could include under one umbrella acts of extortion, bribery, fraud, threats, tax offenses. All of those things can come together because there's one scheme, one goal, to advance the financial fortunes of that organization, and that everybody understood the hierarchy and everybody understood what the game was all about. And so in that way, it can be very useful. It can extend the statute of limitations, reaching back as long as you have a last act occurring within 5 years. You can bring in a federal RICO prosecution, both federal and state predicate crimes. So it's a way of bringing in together what might otherwise be separate cases, but it allows a jury to understand the full scope of criminal activity. And, you know, based on the things that we're hearing here about how Donald Trump conducted his business, we haven't seen the evidence of it, but it's certainly consistent with the kinds of cases that are often brought in racketeering cases.
I want to give you the last word. I'm still just wrapped around what you said about his admiration for John Gotti, and I'm mad at myself for being surprised by it. I mean, he's not someone that has ever been attracted to anyone benevolent, so I don't know why I'm horrified
and
that
I
he admired John
Gotti. And I think we've been talking about this together for like 7 years now,
right.
So I'm surprised you're surprised.
Well, I guess my question would be, I think he'll like that. So when he sees that someone saw him as John Gotti, you could imagine him almost incriminating himself. You know, well, damn right, I'm John Gotti.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he does not want to be seen as John Gotti the criminal. I think he wants to be seen as John Gotti the tough thug. And he certainly in a courtroom, I think, would not want to be compared to Gotti. But he's got people around him who could flip on him. It is like a mob investigation. You know, Alan Weisselberg. I was in an office at Trump Tower with Alan Weisselberg once, and they were supposed to show me Trump's assets adding up to $6 billion. And we went down this long list of assets, and we got to the end, it only added up to $5 billion. And I said, Alan, this only adds up to $5 billion. And he said, let me go to my office and find that other billion.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. To be continued, Barbara McQuaid, Andrew Weissman, Tim O'Brien, thank you for being at the table. When we come back, brand new reporting about the scramble inside the intelligence community to assess the potential damage in the wake of the indictment of a senior FBI official accused of working for the Russian oligarch he was supposed to be investigating. One of the reporters who broke that story will be our next guest. Plus, the gun cult that is today's GOP takes a dark turn, with some MAGA members of Congress replacing their American flag lapel pins with pins of the AR-15. The killing machine used in countless mass shootings in America. And later, our friend, the Reverend Al Sharpton, on the way forward on police reform after the brutal murder of Tyre Nichols. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Good evening. Tonight, the FBI has under lock and key one of its own, a veteran FBI agent with access to the most sensitive and highly classified information in the United States government. Information that he's suspected of selling to the Russians for 15 years.
FBI agents today searched the suburban Washington home of one of their own in the worst spy case in FBI history. Robert Philip Hansen, a 25-year veteran of the FBI, accused of doing, quote, extreme damage to the U.S. Hansen, age 56, specialized in the secretive world of counter-espionage. His job, keeping tabs on suspected Russian spies in the U.S., monitoring the Soviet and Russian missions in New York and their embassies in Washington.
When that story broke 22 years ago this month, the case of Robert Hansen, a veteran FBI agent turned Russian mole, was understandably a worldwide bombshell with massive national security and intelligence implications all around the world. Now, more than two decades later, the Robert Hansen case is newly relevant, being cited again, thanks to Charles McGonigal, the FBI chief who was arrested last week on charges related to money laundering and violating U.S. sanctions on Russia. Like Hansen, McGonigal is a veteran FBI agent who held key positions in counterintelligence. Like Hansen, McGonigal had access to some of the nation's most sensitive, most closely guarded secrets. And like Hansen, McGonigal is accused of working with and for some of the very individuals he was supposed to be investigating. Now, in McGonigal's case, that individual was the notorious Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska. Now, it's different in a lot of ways as well. Unlike Hansen, McGonigal is not. He has not been charged with espionage. Or two indictments, they say nothing about espionage. But according to the New York Times' latest reporting, McGonigal's arrest has, quote, set off a scramble within the Bureau to assess the potential damage and determine whether any counterintelligence or law enforcement operations were compromised, with FBI Director Christopher Wray treating the case as a top priority. As one former FBI counterintelligence officer told the Times, quote, it puts a question mark next to everything McGonigal was involved in. The earliest crimes of which McGonigal is accused date back to August 2017. But the FBI's damage assessment likely is looking back much further, former officials said. That he may have lied while with the Bureau about his acceptance of cash from a business associate and contacts with foreign individuals has also raised concerns about the breadth and duration of his possible deceptions. As we have said before on this program, the Charles McGonigal case raises more questions than it answers, something the New York Times alludes to in its reporting as well. Quote, the betrayal of the agency by someone of Mr. McGonigal's stature for $225,000, if proved, would be surprising, given that former officials can earn significant sums as consultants after retirement on top of hefty pensions. Something that is, as the Times points out, surprising but not unprecedented since Robert Hansen, quote, began cooperating with the Russians in the late 1970s while he was a counterintelligence officer in a unit in New York. So many questions. Joining us to help us try to answer them, New York Times reporter Ken Vogel. His byline is on all that Times reporting that we read from. And Frank Figluzzi, former FBI Assistant Director for Counterintelligence, now an MSNBC National Security Analyst. Ken, take me through what you guys are reporting.
Well, you hit on some of the highlights there, Nicole, and the questions about when this activity started and what type of damage may have been incurred by the Bureau are really at the crux of this, because the indictment charges some crimes where the activity starts in 2017, but there's a big difference between what the Justice Department can charge and what prosecutors believe is a strong case and what the activity may have been and the damage that it may have done to the Bureau, which could have started far earlier. The 2017 activity relates to some work that he did with these Albanian officials, including the prime minister of Albania. And, you know, he's actually taking steps to use the Bureau, sort of weaponize the Bureau against the prime minister's rivals is the allegation there. So in some ways, you're right, it's not espionage. In some ways, like, maybe it kind of worse, because he's actually using the Bureau to help his clients, the clients that he has that he has not reported to the FBI. So there's a lot there. And I think we're only seeing just the very tip of the iceberg in the two indictments.
I mean, Ken, is that behavior that would, if an investigation continues down those lines, would question or probe whether or not he was acting as an agent for them? I mean, you're talking about using the FBI on behalf of foreign clients.
Yeah, and that's certainly the sort of bigger picture here. There is this, and it illuminates this industry, this lucrative industry that we see, where there are Americans who are willing to take big sums of money from foreign interests who want to avail themselves of the Americans' connections to the law enforcement community, the intelligence community, to either get themselves out of trouble, like in the case of Deripaska, he's sanctioned and he wants to try to find a way to get out of sanctions. Or in the case of the Albanians, the allegations here are that they wanted to use the U.S. law enforcement community to go after their rivals. And they found, allegedly, again, a willing participant in Charles McGonigal, who was at the time at the FBI. So there's this industry that happens when people leave the FBI or leave law enforcement and the intelligence community and get paid huge sums of money. Here we're seeing a more insidious aspect of it, which is somebody who's still in the law enforcement community, who is accepting sums to try to navigate or manipulate the law enforcement community to the benefit of his foreign clients.
Frank Figluzzi, there's a conversation about the ethics of what Ken is describing, that when you leave, how do you use your expertise, particularly when it is a national security expertise? But I think Ken's reporting is inching at something probably a lot more pressing to law enforcement and prosecutors. And that is, what other crimes might he have committed and when did they start? And might there be more money involved than the $225,000? What are your questions in those areas?
A lot of questions, some of the same questions I'm sure the FBI is pursuing right now. So what's the conduct alleged in these two indictments out of Washington and New York clearly points to a corrupt senior executive in the FBI, both during the tail end of his tenure and afterwards. The big question is, beyond corruption, are we actually talking about someone who might have turned into a spy? Did a top spy catcher become a spy himself? And if so, when? And so you're talking about someone who led the counterintelligence program in the largest FBI field office in the nation, New York. And not only that, but throughout his career, worked literally some of the most sensitive investigations and operations in the U.S. intelligence community. So they've got to do a damage assessment that reaches backward in time. And one of the things I'm fascinated by is whether this is going to move forward with additional allegations, even possibly with additional FBI personnel retired. Likely there's been some reporting that touches on that possibility. And also, the money thing. I'm fascinated by, of course, the study of people who go south and are corrupt or spy. The FBI has actually conducted extensive study of everyone ever convicted in the United States of espionage and come up with certain conclusions. But we all are wondering which one of those traits, characteristics, scenarios applies to Charlie McGonigal. Was it debt? Was it bitterness? Was it ego? Did he think he should have been higher than he even was? Which, by the way, can't get much higher than that in the counterintelligence field. He could have gone on from New York State in the FBI and become an assistant director, could have named, as has been implied, named his corporate job, although I have to take some issue with the notion that he could have been paid the kind of money in the corporate world that he would have received if he kept doing this. We're seeing information leading that points to tens of thousands of dollars drafted in contracts, $500,000 being bandied about for an introduction involving UN officials. So you can't make that kind of money in corporate security. So what was going on? When did it start? What did he touch? Everything's being looked at.
Frank, let me ask you this. I get that I worked in government. Everyone has a right to make money in the private sector, and his expertise was national security. But to your point about the profile of people who spy, I mean, what is the profile of people who leave the FBI and don't, which I imagine is 99.999% of people? I mean, it can't be hard to leave and use your expertise for good. Most people don't go to work for an international criminal like Deripaska. I mean, who takes the Deripaska account?
Yeah, here's a possible theory, because I actually, our careers intersected briefly 3 or 4 months when I was at the tail end of my career. So I know what Charlie's capable of. He's capable of great hard charging counterintelligence work. And I predict we're going to see a defense here. I can see this coming, that he started at least with the intent of recruiting some of these people, right? There's a problem with that, because when you're the special agent in charge of something in New York, you aren't in the recruitment business. You hand this stuff off as a senior executive if you have the opportunity, right? And so he's going to say that, but then I can see this quickly falling flat, you know, because we see allegations of money laundering and cutouts and bank accounts and envelopes of cash being handed to him and cars and bags of money in his apartment, right? So, you know, he's violating the law. He's lying on financial disclosure forms, right? So this is going to fall flat, but I can see where he might have tried it, right? He might have. And then they recruited him, is what seems to be happening. And there was classic tradecraft here. He was tasked to get this young lady into an internship at NYPD. That's tasking. He knew, he should have seen this coming. Yeah. So the question of ethics and law, just because something is not illegal, doesn't mean it's ethical. And I think that's part of the issue here.
It is one of the most fascinating things happening out there. Ken Vogel, we're glad you're on the beat. Thank you for joining us to talk about your story. Frank Figluzzi, you are sticking around a little bit longer. When we come back, MAGA Republicans sinking to new dystopian depths as they honor a weapon of war used in countless mass shootings in these United States. That story after a quick break.
"26 souls, including 20 babies, massacred at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Parkland, Buffalo, Uvalde, the common denominator, an AR-15-style assault weapon."
"The killers in Uvalde, Buffalo, Las Vegas, Parkland, and Newtown used an AR-15-style rifle."
"It is absolutely wrong. In fact, it is insane. The governor talks about mental health. It is insane that we allow an 18-year-old to go in and buy an AR-15. What the hell did we think he was going to do with that? This one is on us."
It is a tragic fact, but a fact nonetheless, that mass shooters in our country choose AR-15s most of the time as their weapon of choice. It was true at Sandy Hook. was true in San Bernardino. It was true in Las Vegas. It was true in Parkland. Our list could go on and on, but we only have 2 hours. This week, in some kind of bizarre, obnoxious display, two freshman MAGA Republican members of Congress, Anna Paulina Luna and serial liar George Santos, walked through the halls of the U.S. Capitol this week wearing large AR-15 pins in the same spot on their lapels where normal people wear the American flag or the congressional seal or anything else. Their timing could not be worse. It comes less than 2 weeks after a string of deadly mass shootings in America, in California. And while the country lives with the horrifying reality of deadly gun violence nearly every single day. Republican Congressman Andrew Clyde, that's the guy who called January 6th a, quote, normal tourist visit, gleefully took credit for handing out the pins because of the Second Amendment's, quote, importance in preserving our liberties, end quote. Clyde said he has plenty more pins to give out. Let's bring into our coverage the Reverend Al Sharpton, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and the president of the National Action Network. Frank Figluzzi is back with us. Frank Figluzzi, what does the glorification by celebrating the AR-15 on a lawmaker's lapel do to the gun enthusiast?
Boy, it identifies what really matters to these folks, which is the ability to commit mass violence. The data is there, Nicole, as you cited. It's incontrovertible that mass shootings are, by and large, conducted with assault-style weapons, period, end of discussion. When you wear that lapel on, that pin on your lapel, you're saying, I'm all about that. Sign me up for that. And step further here. I'm owned by the NRA. This is who I belong to. So instead of the American flag on the lapel, as many lawmakers do, instead of even, I've seen a Christian cross, as I've seen lawmakers wear on their lapel, we have replaced those symbols with an assault weapon. That's who we seem to stand for these days. And the man who's handing these out, Andrew Clyde from Georgia, yeah, he profits from the gun industry. He has the fourth-ranked gun store in the state of Georgia. So let's look at this for what it is. Not an assertion of the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, but rather profit, killing, and replacing American values with violence.
Rev, I know you've had a really long week, but this story, the Republicans keep showing us who they are. And I'm looking, but do you feel like everyone sees what's happening here?
I hope they do. I mean, you know, Maya Angelou used to say, if somebody tells you who they are the first time, believe them. When you're walking around the Congress and you are wearing an AR-15 that you couldn't say is for hunting, you couldn't say for any of the excuses they've been giving us for the last several years through the mass shootings, then what are you saying to us now that you are now not only saying that you have a Second Amendment right, you're showing us the normalizing of the instrument of mass killing. I mean, have we gotten that sick to where we are just running around parading now, advertising on our lapels what has wiped out all the people that you named in each one of those disasters? And this is sick. I wouldn't expect any better from George Santos. But for others in the Republican caucus not to be attacking that, you're talking about Omar and words. You're talking about these people are wearing this on their lapel. How do the victims of all these mass killings, families feel seeing members of Congress walking around with AR-15 buttons on their lapel?
It's unbelievable. Frank Figluzzi, thank you for sticking around with us. The Rev is staying with us to talk about the week that was, the eulogy he delivered for Tyre Nichols, and what the path forward on police reform looks like. Don't go anywhere.
In the city that Dr. King lost his life, not far away from that balcony, you beat a brother to death. There's nothing more insulting and offensive to those of us that fight to open doors, that you walk through those doors and act
like the folks we had to fight for to get you through them doors. People had to march and go to jail, and some lost their lives to open the doors for you. And how dare you?
Rev, you were still talking when that part of your eulogy started trending. Did you know you were going to say that, or does that come to you in the moment?
Always in the moment. I started, as you know, as a boy preacher, so I never learned how to speak with a manuscript, preach a sermon, or make a speech with a manuscript. When I ran for president and spoke at the Democratic Convention, I went off and did it extemporaneously. But I felt that. I went that morning to the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King was killed. I did Morning Joe from there. And I thought about how when I was a youngster, Jesse Jackson, who mentored me, brought me there and had described to me, because he was there that day, how Dr. King got killed. And I'm saying, we're like 10 minutes away from where they beat this guy to death. And Martin Luther King was in Memphis in 68, fighting for city workers. These are city workers, and this is what he fought for. And all of that was in me when I went to the funeral, and it just had to come out because it is not like it was a normal thing just a few years ago for blacks to be on the elite squad of the police department or to have a black woman as the police chief. And now we're going to inflict the same pain on anyone. This happened to be a black man unarmed. But on anyone, if it was any citizen, we didn't fight to get you in there to match brutality. We didn't want to get you in there for you to behave in the ways that if we said if the force reflected the population, it would change the conduct. You're acting just as bad or worse. This is inexcusable. And the pain of that mother and stepfather, and now I've met his siblings, is something that cannot go unanswered.
I can't get over the pain of Tyre Nichol. I mean, we were on together last Friday, I guess an hour, our show ended an hour before the tape came out. And what this young man was subjected to, not just by the five officers, but the depraved indifference of the emergency responders, that everyone kind of pulls up and looks at his body like it's not a human being, suffering gravely by that point, is so horrific to me. And I wonder what our obligation is as human beings to make sure this stops.
I think the obligations are that they must be held accountable, first of all, because for them not to be held accountable is to make it normalized, which is why I'm glad in the last 2 years, Nash Action Network, my group, working with other groups, working with Attorney Ben Crump, has seen people held accountable. People can say, well, all they want, what's going to happen? Well, I remember we couldn't get police indicted. Now you've got
or tapes.
Killer. Yeah. Now you have the killers of George Floyd in jail, policemen. You have Ahmaud Arbery's in jail. So we are seeing things we did not ever have a victory. Now we need the law, federal law, including dealing with this whole question of qualified immunity. And the president has addressed it. He met with the Congressional Black Caucus. The vice president was at the funeral. The victories of the 60s was in changing the laws. That's what I learned from the King movement. We need to change the laws. If we can't change people's hearts, we can definitely change the law and make them abide by federal law.
How do you make Republicans and good cops, which is the majority of cops, part of the coalition that wants to change the laws?
I think that the fact that this was so brutal and so filmed as brutal, like you said, even when the emergency people got there, they never checked on him. They weren't even checked. They just let the man lay there. And the question, and I'm sure to come out of trial, is if they had been more attentive, could he have lived? He lived 3 days. I mean, there's going to be a lot of questions here. And I think that as we are now almost already in the 24th season and there's some Senate seats up, we may be able to get some senators to do what is right and what is decent. The president is invited and the Congressional Black Caucus, some of the victims from around the country, to be at the State of the Union. And I think that's good. We have a president that's setting a tone and a vice president. But the tone must be that we need to have law. How can we have a society that this is allowable?
We should not. And for you, I know you're the first, for you and your friend and partner in many of these tragedies, Benjamin Crump, you're the first people there when these families need you. It was really evident how important you are in their life, watching everything.
And I stay in their life. I mean, I'm dealing with families.
And you brought them all together. I saw all the families.
But I'm dealing with families that we fought the cases 30 years ago. I'm part of their family. They're part of mine. They helped my kids grow up. And I think that you, because you understand the bond, and I think it's important that we understand that, because they're human beings. They are not props for your next performance.
Rev, I am glad to be in your TV family. Thank you.
Thank you
for being here. Thank you for coming here at the end of this week. And we'll be watching Politics Nation this weekend. A quick break for us. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes for another week of shows. We are so grateful.